Welcome to the Honeycomb Podcast. We're bringing you a special collab with Visa Wellington on a Plate to present the Wellington Food Story Speaker Series, taking place at the Museum of New Zealand, Te Papa Tongariwa. In each episode, you'll hear about Wellington's unique past and present food stories, as told by Wellingtonian chefs, historians, and storytellers. On this episode, Liz Mellish talks through the importance of food in Wellington's history from the perspective of tangata whenua.
Kia ora. Ko te ahu mairangi, te moanga, ko pai kawakawa te awa, ko seramiku, tuku ingoa, no te whanganui atara aho. Kia ora. Good afternoon. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Sarah Meikle and I'm the Festival Director of Visa Wellington on a Plate. And it's an absolute pleasure to welcome you here today to the first of the Wellington Food Story Speaker Series presented by Te Papa here at Te Marae. I'd like to thank Lauren Campbell and Ian Crowe and the wonderful whānau here at Te Papa for their support in making this speaker series possible. So today we welcome Liz Mellish to speak to us for the first in this series of these talks. Liz has an accomplished business career spanning over 40 years, and she's now, among many other senior roles, the chairperson of Te Rokawa Atsurikura Whareiwaka in here in Wellington and serves on the Māori Heritage Council. The speaker series this year was inspired by a conversation with Liz. One of my team met with her to discuss Matariki, and from that meeting we learnt of the importance and the history of food for tangata whenua here in Wellington and wanted to be able to share this with a wider audience. So without further ado, I welcome Liz. Kia ora. Kia ora,
Sarah. Ina mana, ina reo, ina raurangi tirama, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, katoa. Tēnei te mihi the team at Te Papa, and particularly I want to thank Fran Wild, the chairman of your board, who cannot be here due to the fact that she's had an operation and is hopefully resting at home and recovering from that. Sarah, I just want to say thank you to you. I met Sarah on a business trip to China, actually, and we hit it off, and I'm very pleased to support Sarah's Wellington on a Plate, which was really her brainchild, and she's worked very hard on it. Today, I'm not talking to you as a chef, because a chef I am not. I have a husband who's a chef. And so I am the partaker of the kai, and must I say that he's a hunter-gatherer, and so I've been one of those lucky people, and you can see I'm not exactly skinny Lizzie either, and that is because of the importance of food in my life. So what I want to talk to you today about really is about Te Whanganui Ātara, about Wellington and the kai that was here before 1840. And, you know, we as Māori had a fabulous diet. We were much skinnier than I am. We were extremely fit, and we actually lived very long lives. And I go back to my tūpuna, who often lived to well into their 90s, and that was because of the type of food that they ate, and much of it is available here in Wellington. So it is important to us. In saying that, the fact that we built Te Whareiwaka, or Te Raukura, the Whareiwaka, on the waterfront in Wellington was so we could start to bring that culture. I mean, Wellington's exciting for food and the cafe scene, and that's really what you've captured, Sarah. But actually, there wasn't anybody doing Māori kai. And to be fair, even we have had to modify and manage, but actually that's what Māori do, that's what all peoples do. We manage with the food that we're able to together and to look after. So this sort of really is talking about four things. And we're talking about the moana, we're talking about the awa, we're talking about the nahiri, and we're talking about the mara. And they're four essential places for the collection and gathering of kai. So, as you can see, here's a picture of our fabulous Te Whanganui Ātara, and our harbour is a big sink. And, you know, the joyful thing about our harbour is the water flows in and the water flows out. So pelagic fish come in to this season. So we live very seasonally. So let's start off with talking about the moana. That's the best segue. Now, when we talk about the moana, we do talk about the harbour. And in the harbour, guess what? We have pawa, we have kina, we have pipis, we have mussels, and of course, the absolutely fabulous kauri. And so that was really important to have that in the picture. They were really staple foods. But alongside the moana, the harbour is an even more important food source called raukaua moana, which of course you would know as Cook Strait. And Cook Strait is absolutely abundant with food because of the nutrients in that very exciting patch of water that's often turbulent, has dangerous currents, but man, does it grow beautiful pawa, pipis, all of these things that you can see within that one photo were in great supply. But not only that, of course, were the pelagic fish, were the whales, were all of those, the hoki beds. I don't know if you know, but the Port Nicholson Trench is where the hoki breed. So we're always very mindful of ensuring that pollution doesn't hit those beds, because not only do they feed the North Island, they also feed the South Island. And when I first started on my RMA journey, our kaumātua from the top of the south, Te Tauī, who said, don't forget you have a strong responsibility to protect that marine fishery, because that's our life. And I'll talk about that life in relation to food in a moment. And then the next slide really talks about the Nahiri. And of course, if you look at Wellington today, you can't see much of it, but very nice to walk up the entranceway to Te Marae. And that is looking out at that Nahiri, which is really a very small picture, but it's very beautiful. And the Tuis love it, and they come, don't they? And so these two birds were absolutely abundant in Wellington and the Hutt Valley. And they were staple food diets. And if you read Jeff Park's book, Nauru Ora, you will see his writings about the state of the Hutt Valley and how abundant that was with bird life. He talked about kerridu being in flocks of 1,000. Can you imagine that? And you can imagine when the settlers came and they arrived in January 22nd, they saw those birds and it would have reminded them very much of pheasants and all and those things. And they were so easy to shoot, it was incredibly, it was so easy, it was ridiculous. But, you know, those wonderful birds feed on berries and fruits, and sometimes they get a bit, you know, drunk, really, is the only way I can describe it. And so they're very easy to find, beautiful when cooked, and no, I'm not saying we should go out and do that now. I want to make that absolutely clear. Tempting as it is, absolutely not. Not until we get back to flocks of 1,000, and then we can think about it. So, you know, let's plant trees, but let's plant native trees that feed them. And of course, the beautiful and bossy tui also was a staple food for us. And they were also pretty easy to catch. They were also pretty easy to train and keep as a you know, like a parrot. So tui were pretty famous in our repertoire, and they still are. And I suspect they were pretty delicious too. I don't know. And I honestly don't know. At the bottom of the picture, you'll see karaka. And if you are next to the wharewaka, you'll see that karaka are the tree of choice there, and that there was a grove planted there. And when that grove was planted, it wasn't consultation with us as the iwi. And it really reflects that Taraka was not indigenous to New Zealand, but it came with the fleet canoes. And we planted karaka because it's a staple food when all else fails, and usually that's pretty horrible weather. But I will say they're pretty poisonous if you don't treat them properly. And so there is a whole process and requirement to eat them. But, you know, they were a necessary food for us when times were a little bit tough. Above the karaka, of course, is a fern. And particularly the mamaku was a fern we used a lot. And the interesting thing is the mamaku is the ponga with the very black fronds. You know, the rib in the ponga is black. And you could actually cut them and take out a section and push the top back on and it would regrow. But the bit that you cut off was delicious to eat and also was exceptionally useful as a rongoa. And rongoa is a word that describes our well-being, our health. And because of the nahiri and the trees that grew only in New Zealand, only in Aotearoa, the rongoa properties are huge. And why do I make such a claim that the nahiri in Aotearoa is different from anywhere else? It is because we had no browsing animals in Aotearoa. We had no cows, we had no sheep. We only had bats, we had kuri, which are dogs, and we had mice, rats. And they were the only browsing animals that were in Aotearoa. So our nahiri developed differently from everywhere else in the world. Only place in the world that had this type of environment without mammals. And what that meant was the trees did not develop prickles, did not develop a metabolism that meant that the food tasted awful and stopped animals from browsing, didn't need to. So our trees, our ferns, our vegetables are all beautiful and without all of those awful mechanisms that make you, you know, not want to eat them. They didn't have to develop defence mechanisms. Now we come to the word mara, which of course means cultivation. Of course we were cultivators, we were horticulturalists. We absolutely understood the soil, we understood the forest, and we understood how to grow. So in this slide, I've put up two words because it's really important in here. So at the bottom of the picture, of course, you would recognise kumara. On the right, you will see aruhi, so that's the fern root, which was also a very staple diet. If all else failed, you could eat that. It took a lot of work, actually, to make it work. It had to be roasted and pounded and opened up, and you had to eat what was the inside of the root, and it was complicated, but it was very good and very supportive of Māori communities. The left-hand photo is important because that's Noku Tefatefa, which is a pātaka that sits in the Dowse Museum in Lower Hutt. And it's very representative of Te Atiawa. It was actually carved by the first Te Huhu of Te Wharetoa for Wetako Ngātata, who was the rangatira at the time in Wellington and actually sat in the Legislative Council, which was in those times the second House of Parliament. So in the 1800s, there were two parliaments, and he sat in which is equivalent to the House of Lords. And I thought it was important to put that pātaka there because to survive our volatile weather in Wellington, we actually needed to store food. And so a pātaka is a storehouse. That particular storehouse, of course, didn't store food. It was built specifically to store mana and knowledge, and it has another long story which I won't go into today, but it really gives you a reflection of how we lived and how we managed in this environment of Aotearoa New Zealand. And so that's why the word mana is important, but the word underneath is also important, and it's manaaki. And for our mana, the important thing we have to do as Te Atiawa Taranaki Whānui is to look after all of the people who come into Wellington, into Te Whanganui Ātara. Our principal role and the principal meaning of kai, of food, is to be able to provide sufficient to feed the visitors, the manuhiri, into our place. And we take that responsibility seriously. And we still do today. And that doesn't mean I'm going to shout you all a meal at the whare waka, okay? But it does mean that we have to look after the environment to ensure that we can gather food and provide it, and particularly at our marae, particularly as we welcome in manuhiri. And, you know, for us, the mana comes from being able to put crayfish in numbers on the table, to put oysters in number on the table, pippies, all of those things, and the food of the nahiri, and to use the food of the cultivation. I just want to quickly tell you about some of the cultivation areas. And as we sit here in Lambton Harbour, as it's known today, there are three major pā sites, Te Aro Pā, Kumutoto Pā, and Pipitia. And they were large and they were very important in the story. Pre-1840 and post-1839 when the New Zealand Company guys arrived. And what was surprising was the amount of cultivations we had, and each pā had its own cultivation sites. And I want to talk about Pipitia first, and their cultivation is actually where the beehive sits. And it's called Kaiota, makes sense, and it was in between some streams that came off Ahu Mairangi, our main maunga in Wellington. And so when you look at the beehive, you have to think about, actually, that is where we cultivated. And it was extensive. If we think about where the botanical gardens are and Orangi Kaupapa, I think it really should be Oranga. I've always had that debate about that name. But we all know that area as Wellingtonians. Well, that was a huge cultivation. And if you can think about where the housing is and where the botanical gardens are, it was terraced, the whole lot, and that was cultivations. And that was particularly for Kumutoto Pā. And Pipitia stream actually starts up in the botanical gardens and runs out under Wellington Girls College. Under the city lies all this information that we just have to scratch the surface off to find. And talking about Pipitia, that is really talking about pippies. So at Pipitia Point, which is about where Davis Street comes onto Thorndon Quay and where the river runs, was called Pipitia because that was where the biggest and tastiest pippy grew. And the tear bit is really talking about the clear water of the Pipitia stream meeting the sea, meeting the harbour, and running over top of those pippies, which made them sweeter and tastier and perfect for us. And they were extensive. And what, they're under the railway line in the stadium now. So you can see those food sources that were there and are now no longer there. For Te Aro Pā, which is just really behind us, the cultivations ran all the way to Island Bay. So if you think about getting past Pukeahu or Mount Cook, and you see those hills running all the way on the right-hand side of Island Bay, that was all cultivation. 100 acres of cultivation. And we've got maps that show all of that, that we did particularly, so that in thinking about Wellington, we're very clear about where that soil was, where the water was. You know, we're all gardeners. We know how this works. You have to have all those wonderful things to make it work. And to conclude, I'm just watching the time, Sarah. I just want to raise the question of the hour. So I've got three important pictures. One is of tuna or eel. One is of watercress. And the further right-hand one is whitebait. Now, they were in abundance here. And just to our right is a stream called Waitangi Stream that comes through Waitangi Park. And do you know today there are still eels in there that travel all the way to the Basin Reserve? And you talk to any drain layer who's had to dig it up and clean it up, they always come across eels. And so it's, you know, so it's important. So when I was talking with Catherine Ryan on Radio New Zealand the other day, I suggested we remove Queen Victoria, that we take out the big middle, you know, grass lane, which was actually built for a canal to travel to the basin. Seriously, the plans are still in the Wellington City Council record. Let's dig it up. Let's open up the stream. Let's put coffee shops up there, Sarah. Let's make it much nicer. Right now, it's a bit windy, it's a bit cold, and it's a hell of a road to get across. If you want to cross from one side to the other, for what purpose? And we could put a really good cycleway in. Just saying, it'd be easy, wouldn't it? But, you know, the other thing that went up there, of course, was whitebait. And I suspect they still go up there too. But of course, what the difficulty is for whitebait is having no habitat to breed in. Eels, of course, have a whole different journey. So that's one river I want to talk about. Pipitea, I've talked about. You don't see Pipitea Stream either, except at the Botanical Gardens. There's a whole raft of streams in Wellington that are very important to the kai, into the story of the city, that currently are called drains, and they're all piped, and we don't see the effect of those. All over the world there is now discussion. I think in Korea they've opened up streams, Germany's another place that is doing that. So when we talk about food, we're really wanting to revive good food, healthy food, based on good water, good sunshine, good soil, and you can't have one without all the others to make the garden grow. And this is a garden. I see people fishing straight outside here. You know, isn't that amazing in a capital city? Isn't it amazing that we get scallops here, that we get crayfish here, that we get pawa here? I can tell you there was a time we wouldn't eat them. In the time when sewage ran into the harbour from both all of the Hutt Valley and all of Wellington. And we stopped that, and I credit Ray Ahapini Musa as the fighter for that, and along with a whole group of us, and, you know, he kept saying, look at this, look at this. And the Kaumātua took me up to the Mount Crawford prison, heaven forbid, and said, but look. And every day at 4 o'clock, all the paru staff went out and joined and went out through the heads every day. We've stopped doing that. We are getting better. But for kai, for the ambience of this city and the Hutt Valley, we have to keep making sure that we can access food, that we can demonstrate that we care, that it's important for manaakitanga, it's important for our mana, it's important, obviously, for all people. And so, have I done my... And so I'm really ready to take questions from anybody around all of this conversation, and I'm really ready to add to it. I'll tell you what I do, and quickly, one hour I want to talk about, and that's in the Hutt Valley, and that's the river you know as the Hutt River and we know as Te Awa Kairangi. And if you think about that name, it's talking about food. And that river was absolutely loaded, absolutely loaded. The kahawai, of course, went up. The piharo, the tuna, the kokopu, you know, all of those fish, those species. When you get to Taita, you know, which is about where you hit the difference between upper and lower Hutt, you know, that was the best place to catch the eels because, of course, the Taita Gorge narrowed in. And so, you know, a traditional tuna gathering place. And so, you know, you could have your choice. You could send your hunter-gatherer out and say, I'll have a kiriru tonight and a bit of tui and a bit of something else and tomorrow night we'll have fish. You know, that's how it was. It very quickly changed, of course, with the destruction of the Nahiri. But you can see it was a very fertile place. And I think it's really appropriate that Wellington on a plate relates specifically to the fact that this was a beautiful food basket. And it still is. And it still is the place where you go for kai. I mean, we all travel it. It's what we're famous for. And so I think that's a bit exciting. Questions, people? Well, aren't you a wonderful... Yes, Sarah.
Thank you. I'm interested to know when you talk about what was cultivated, so grown, and I live in Island Bay, so I drive up and down that stretch of road every day. What were they growing? What was predominant?
Well, the predominant food really was kumara. And when the fleet canoes came, they brought various seeds and plants to grow, but really they didn't do too well, certainly not in Wellington, certainly in the far north, but really down here it was a different situation. So kumara was really the staple food and we needed to grow lots and we needed to store them. So that was hugely important. And I think that gave the starch. One of the difficulties we had, of course, was lack of protein. Because we didn't have cows and pigs and sheep and lambs and stuff. And it was important to have the birds. And dare I say it was probably important to have whales. I know that seems terrible today, but in those times, that was quite important. And Raukawa Moana, Cook Strait, was a real passageway for whales, and that's why we had the big whaling. You know, the sealers and whalers were here pretty early on, understanding that. But I don't think we'll see that on the menu anytime soon.
And when Pākehā arrived, did they eat a lot of those foods as well, or did they promptly, you know, come in and plant all of their carrots and potatoes?
Well, it's sort of interesting, of course, when the New Zealand Company arrived in 1839, they brought, obviously, lots of animals. They brought horses and cows and sheep and so on. But the whalers and sealers had been here much earlier. So they'd already, and Captain Cook had left his pigs behind in the top of the south, so I have no doubt we probably scooted over in a walker and picked some up and brought them over. So we were somewhat already very much understanding. Believe it or not, the other thing we did was we grew wheat because we got that through the sealers and whalers as well. And that grew in Fitzroy Bay across the harbour. And that quite surprises people, but it's well recorded about the large wheat farms and the flour mills that Māori owned. And believe it or not, we were already exporting to Australia. So we were trading in and out of Australia and probably all over the Pacific long before the New Zealand Company arrived.
Liz, with Taranaki whānau being obviously in Taranaki as well, did you share food between the two places?
Certainly did. And, of course, we always say that the pāwa down here are much bigger than those Taranaki. And it's true because it's a different type of pāwa. And we'd also whizzed down the top of the south because, my gosh, their kina were just outstanding. Still are. But, yeah, of course. And that goes back to that practice of manaakitanga. So, you know, we never travelled without taking kai, because as we that are all sitting here, we know how important kai is to all of us and to our well-being. It is somewhat the centre of our lives, really, is that survival and having kai. Mm.
The thing I'm just interested in, no, it doesn't really relate to food, but can you tell me a bit more about Te Aropā?
About?
Te Aropā. Just being right, obviously, in this area in terms of Taranaki Street and the importance of that to Te Atiawa.
Oh, look, it was really important. What happened in Te Aropā, that was the hapū of two other Taranaki tribes, Ngāti Ruanui and Ngāti Tama. And so their two tribes, their hapū had been actually on the Kapiti Coast. And there's a long story about battles and, you know, a bit of argy-pargy going on. And so they came in at our invitation to Te Aropā. And Te Atiawa were here. So previous to us coming, there was Ngāti Tama and there was Ngāti Mutunga, who actually captured a boat called the Rodney and shot off to the Chatham Islands. And I can understand that because the kai over there is outstanding. And if there's anywhere to go for crayfish and blue cod, it's the Chatham Islands. So, you know, and when they left, they handed over to Te Atiawa. So there was a process. And they burnt their houses to signify that they were leaving and leaving forever. And that was a conscious decision. And that's what happened. Actually, the tribe at Te Aro was Taranaki, not Ngāti Tama. Taranaki, so it was the two hapū out of those two tribes, one in South Taranaki and one around the mountain. Mm.
Was there a particular kind of kai that was famous?
Which was?
Was famous. Like, would people travel here to have certain kinds of foods?
I think koda crayfish was, like, pretty much the jewel in the crown. And you'll see in, you know, in the written accounts that we've got of what people were eating, it was certainly that. But there were, tuna is the other one that was absolutely important, and believe it or not, blind eels, which I don't know if you've ever seen a blind eel, it's pretty revolting, but my uncles used to cook them all the time, and kereru were just reka, just tasty and delicious and certainly used. But then there were other foods, like survival foods, like supplejack, like hurupito. Oops, we're using that today. All of those things were added to that culinary effort. And families had their own hāngi, and it wasn't big. You know, when we think of a hāngi today, we think of feeding a couple of hundred people. We don't think about just feeding a whānau, but obviously that's exactly what happened. And often with fish it was smoked and dried, so there were drying racks. So your day was really important, either for cultivation or gathering and preserving and looking after, because that was important. So things like bull kelp, which were used as containers for birds, and birds with fat. We see that with titi. We did have titi, and they're coming back into Wellington on Machu Island. We've worked on bringing species back. So, you know, much more was here than is here today. Yes?
What, was there freshwater kura in the streams?
Absolutely. They're still here. If you can find the headwaters of a stream. Not many can you find. You have to know where they are in Wellington, but they are here, yes, and they're certainly in the heart. Mm. And they were a delicacy too.
Hello. I'm very, very keen on kina. I love it. And we have some very good friends who sometimes bring us kina when they've gone out diving. His koro really enjoys leaving the kina out and having it ferment. And he's always like, ugh, it's disgusting. But apparently the older generation really, really love that. And I just wanted to know what it tasted like, what the appeal was, why they did that, and how, yeah.
It's another form of preserving, really, and we did it with corn. Rotten corn, we called it, and I'll never forget my first experience of eating that. But, you know, a bottle of cream makes some medicine go down. And it's like anything, it's an acquired taste, but we also did that with coda. The water was clear, was clean, and really looked after the animal. And a bit like having a natural pataka or fridge, really, to look after that kai and keep it going. So if you're brought up on that, of course it's delicious, and certainly, you know, my father and my uncles and aunties all ate all of that. I struggled with some of it, to be perfectly frank, but I have to say that kina is like eating gold. But that took a while. And my experience of learning to eat kina was an auntie sitting me down at the marae and started off in the morning that I ate it with Madeira cake. By lunchtime, I was eating it with a potato. By tea time, I was eating it. And so that was the sweet and the starchy potato. Did you go through that journey? I did. How to learn to eat kina. And now, you know, it's just glorious food.
I'm in the fridge at the moment, so.
Yeah. I'm coming to your house. What's your address? So is there any other questions? If not, we're up to our 44th minute. So, Sarah, can I just say thank you to Wellington on a Plate, the team that's sitting here, but particularly to you.
Well, kia ora and thank you, Liz. That's fascinating. I think certainly for myself and the team at the Visa Wellington on a Plate, the last few years have been quite a journey in learning about our local kai and New Zealand and our history. And it's so exciting to see actually a real kind of sort of renaissance and people wanting to learn more about what was here before Pākehā arrived. And yeah, it's been fascinating hearing about that. I've heard some of Liz's stories before, so she's just added to that, which is great. And thank you all very much for coming today. This is the first, obviously, in a series. So next Wednesday, we have Redma Iska coming to speak, sort of shooting forward about 50, 80 years, and actually talking to us about the genesis of Wellington's coffee culture, which I think many will be surprised to hear a little bit about where it actually came from, and it started probably a lot earlier than you realised. So next Wednesday, back here at 12 noon for the next instalment. And finally, just to thank you very much again to Te Papa. Oh, okay, it's not going to be in here, it's going to be in another space, that's fine, just follow the signs. And apart from that, go out and enjoy this beautiful day and have a wonderful week enjoying Visa Wellington on a Plate. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the special series of Honeycomb episodes in collaboration with Visa Wellington on a Plate. We're bringing you another episode next week, so make sure you subscribe to this podcast on your favourite listening app.